The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the October 30th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Upstate by Emma Klein. Before the rental could be confirmed, Chuna wanted Kate's full name and the full name of her boyfriend. Chuna wanted to know the license plate number of the car they'd be driving. Chuna wanted to remind them, before their arrival, that shoes were not to be worn in the house. Chuna wanted to be very clear, yet again, that no pets were allowed. They would not be bringing any pets, correct? There was only a small profile photo of Chuna on the website, but even from that sliver with some burly bearded husband or boyfriend half in the frame, Kate could tell that she was attractive. They didn't live in this house, Chuna and whoever was in the picture with her. It was obvious from the online calendar how often the place was rented. But the profile said that they lived nearby, would be available if there were any issues. The house was 2 hours away. It was a hot day, like the inside of a dog's mouth. Kate forgot to pack shorts, so she changed into a pair of Paul's old swim trunks. Paul drove, his hand on Kate's leg. The car was Paul's family car, his son's surf wax in the cup holder, dog hairs on the back seat. They didn't have to worry anymore about accidentally leaving any damning evidence of Kate behind. Paul had been divorced for almost a year now. He and his ex-wife still shared the car. The dog, with his many medications and nightly steroid shots, had been remanded to the ex's household. A mostly civil detente these days. Paul didn't want to talk about her or the divorce, newly moral. He had cut his gray hair shorter, too, and almost monkish style. Another kind of penance, Kate thought. Now, Kate spat a piece of gum back into its wrapper, folded the wrapper into a napkin. Then she unscrewed the cap of an empty water bottle and stuffed the gum and napkin inside. Collecting garbage in garbage. Efficient. A nesting doll of trash. I love driving in the city, Paul said, making the turn onto the highway. But he looked tense, shoulders up around his ears. He had told Kate once that he didn't mind being stuck in traffic, but that also seemed untrue. At least it had the time he'd yelled at a driver who wouldn't let him merge. The vitriol was startling, Paul smiling wildly. "Thank you," he shouted inside the car, his grin eating his whole face. "Thank you so effing much." The sliding glass door was a wall of coolness at their backs when they sat on the porch to undo their laces, their bags beside them. They used the electronic keypad to open the door with the code Chuna had provided. The house was small and boxy, the stairs running up along the stone fireplace. "It's great," Kate said, wandering the rooms in her bare feet. There were plants and a sun catcher squeezing out rainbows of light, and a pretty wood-countered kitchen. A droopy linen hammock was strung across a corner of the living room to pseudo-bohemian effect. "It's a nice place, huh?" Paul said. He looked pleased, though Kate had been the one who found the listing, set everything up. But Paul had paid, so there was that. Kate opened the refrigerator. A former guest had left a single rolling rock, a half-used bottle of maple syrup drooling in the door, a jar of fizzy-looking mustard that should probably be thrown away. Not by her. She unloaded the beer, the groceries, though they hardly counted as groceries. They'd mostly brought snacks. The kitchen was nice enough, but they would go out to eat. Kate didn't really enjoy cooking, and neither did Paul. There were no photos anywhere, no personal effects. The clues came in the books on the shelves. The Dance of Anger, The Hyperactive Child, Mating in Captivity. The presence of this book, Kate theorized, meant that there was an 80% chance that someone in the couple had recently cheated, the book part of a strenuous joint effort to rebrand infidelity. Was the perpetrator Chuna or the bearded husband? The information packet requested that guests not enter the downstairs closet. The internet router is located in this private closet, the instructions read. But please contact us first if there is an issue with the internet. Of course, Kate and Paul looked in the downstairs closet, opened the door to see straw hats, out-of-season clothing, boots, and hanging jackets, an unplugged laser printer on top of a cardboard box. There were leather notebooks in a stack, diaries. Kate discovered when she opened one, and she flipped through the pages for a bit before she realized she was looking for her own name, and that was crazy. Jolted by his recent 55th birthday, Paul had finally kicked a decades-old cigarette habit. In its place, he ate at least 2 bars of dark chocolate a day. He broke them into perfect squares with the wrapper still on to prevent mess. It seemed like another wish for a new self. Now he was dismantling a bar at the counter and reading work emails. "Do people ever go in the hammock, you think?" Kate said. "Or is it just there to be cute?" She hoisted herself into it. Instantly, the fabric swallowed her up. Was it comfortable lying there or not comfortable? Not really comfortable. Kate poked her head out of the hammock. "Take a picture." Paul paused his work on the chocolate bar to hold up his phone. "Let me see," she said. Paul came over with the chocolate breath and handed her the phone. She zoomed in on her own face. "Eh," she said, though she swiftly sent the photo to herself. It took not insignificant effort to get out of the hammock. All these towns where there was nothing to do but walk up and down the sidewalks and go in and out of small stores. The ritual seemed important, though, the getting out of the city. Even if you mainly did the same things you would do there, at least here, you were relieved of the fatigue of choice. There was only one of everything. One Thai restaurant, one coffee place, one bakery. They walked all the way to the river. The river didn't look so wide from here. It was a flat, dull green. They stepped out on the rocks and then stepped back. The train tracks ran right alongside the water. Paul took multiple photos of the river. Kate hated photos without people in them. "No one ever looks at those kinds of pictures again," she said. But Paul disagreed. And maybe Paul did look at his photos. What did Kate know? Maybe he was regularly scrolling back through his archive of flowers and sunsets and mountaintop views, the collection of things he'd seen, a full moon recorded on his phone as a blurry gape of light. Paul wanted to go a little way down a private driveway. "Just to check it out," he said. He surprised Kate sometimes, what rules he'd break and what rules he'd obey. There were bee boxes stacked in a field. He didn't know what they were. She did. It was satisfying to have the whiff of rural knowledge. Paul had grown up going to the beach for the summer months. He was passionate about the ocean. This was represented by the blue rubber bracelet he wore on his wrist until Kate made fun of it, and he stopped wearing it. It had been some type of charity clean-up the ocean thing. Kate kept looking at the train tracks. It felt as though a train would come barreling through at any second, and they were both bracing for it. No train came. Already the day seemed extremely long. They'd walked the length of Main Street, browsed through any store they could conceivably enter. It was barely lunchtime. There was a swimming hole nearby that was meant to be quieter, more beautiful than the popular swimming hole. A friend had recommended it. There were detailed instructions on a message board about how to get to the special swimming hole, but the web page wouldn't fully load. You were supposed to park on some other road and hike in. There were coordinates, but they didn't have enough service for Google Maps. Paul was no help. Why did Kate always end up with people who didn't know what was happening, who were as unsure of themselves as she was? They just went to the popular swimming hole, finally. After driving for a while in one direction and then turning around, stopping to ask a man in a toll booth that turned out to be the entrance to a private club. He was listening to the radio and wearing a blue uniform shirt. "You can try that way," he said, pointing to an unmarked dirt road. But neither of them was that kind of person. They parked with dozens of other cars. "It's going to be packed," Paul said, preemptively annoyed. And they were both, Kate was sure, picturing the better swimming hole they hadn't been able to find, and the better versions of themselves who were having a much better time there. Kate carried their towels and snacks in a paper grocery bag. Paul was older, had raised a family. Shouldn't he have thought to bring a tote bag for the weekend? And sunscreen, too? Shouldn't one of them be the kind of person who kept track of the procurement and deployment of such things? The tools that smoothed over life's little discomforts? They were like garbage pail kids, Kate thought. No sunscreen, no tote, humping along the sunny bank with their paper sack, the threat of its ripping imminent. They'd eaten the salami and bread in their kitchen before heading out, ravenous, and brought what was left, the fat supermarket strawberries and a bag of Lay's and a bottle of pink lemonade, now warm. High fructose, blah, blah. Two peaches that weren't very good. Kate smelled the stems, and they smelled like nothing. Some days she ate 10 nectarines in a row. They were consistently less disappointing than peaches. The water was cold. They watched some teenagers jumping off rocks. "I read a book," Kate said, "where this guy's wife dies after jumping into a swimming hole. Like, she has some terrible spinal injury." Paul made a neutral sound. "I think it could happen to me," Kate said, "as punishment." Paul didn't ask for what. He told her that lately he had imagined getting a brain tumor. When she finally went to swim, she shuddered from the cold. "Look at you," Paul said, already in up to his neck and treading water. "Such a baby." And now she kept shivering, but she wasn't sure anymore if it was a real impulse or if she was just performing in the ways he wanted her to. "Once, early on," Paul had said, "let's tell each other whenever we feel like we're acting false." And Kate had stiffened because suddenly it all seemed false. She stuck her hand back into a container of blueberries and sifted for a fresh one, a firm one, and agreed. But the air in the apartment felt changed, and so she looked at her phone. More teenagers showed up. Their antics were nerve-wracking. There was much climbing of rocks, many daredevil jumps. The rocks had furry caps of algae that looked slippery. Kate tried to stop anticipating calls for help. The snacks were long gone, the paper grocery bags stuffed with their trash. Paul's nose was getting sunburned. "Ready?" he said. "This way," Paul said, and Kate ducked under a branch to follow him up from the bank. She carried her clothes in her shoes, the towels in her arms. She kept checking to make sure she hadn't dropped anything. Back in the parking lot, she stood at the passenger door. The asphalt started to burn her bare feet. She shifted from foot to foot. Paul had hidden the car keys in the front right tire well. "They're gone," he said, stricken. "Gone?" Her arms were full. She wanted to be inside the car in the air conditioning. She pulled at the door handle. Paul was on his knees, checking the ground. Kate pulled the door handle again. She dropped her shoes on the asphalt and shoved her feet half in. A dread was making itself known. This wasn't fun. "Oh, Jesus," Paul said, standing up. "This isn't my car." Kate looked at the back seat. There was stuff in there, but it was unclear if it was their stuff. Maybe it belonged to Paul's children. There was a blue towel and a travel neck pillow. Were these objects familiar or unfamiliar? "Seriously? Look!" And yes, there was exactly the same car across the parking lot. This car was the same make as Paul's car, the same color, but it was not Paul's car. They had come up a different path to the parking lot and got turned around. "Jesus," he said as they walked over. "I was freaking out." "And here we go," he said, holding the keys up from the tire well. "You sure this is our car?" she said. "Are you joking?" Kate got in without responding, kicked her feet out of her untied shoes. She didn't say that the car felt weird, like a totally alien car, though it was their car because here was her little bottle of trash and there were the dog hairs stippling the back seat. Paul had Norcos from his son's wisdom teeth extraction, and they split one back at the house, both of them wet-haired from the shower. They lay on the carpet in front of the fireplace, though it was too hot to actually make a fire. Kate had two beers. She felt her eyes go a bit dreamy. "We should get in," Paul said, "the hammock." Neither of them moved from the carpet. They had sex there on the floor, mostly to underscore to each other that they were indeed on vacation. Uh-oh. She had bled a bit on the rug, she saw afterward. Juna seemed like the type who would notice and charge a fee. She looked up how to get blood stains out of carpet, dish soap. There was only the hippie kind in the house, perhaps not toxic enough to clean anything, but Kate scrubbed hard. The stain relaxed, and then mostly disappeared. Nearly time for dinner. Finally, the hours up here seemed to pass at half speed. An artist had bought a building in town and turned it into a nice restaurant, the kind of place where the waiters had to wear striped shirts and linen half aprons and serve the usual roster of updated classics, the roast chicken and the parsnip mash. They'd made a 5 p.m. reservation, embarrassing, but they would have gone earlier if it were possible. They were lying on the floor, talking. Paul's eldest daughter was getting a nose job. She had just turned 17. This bothered Kate to a degree she couldn't explain. "Can't she just wait?" she said. "She might change her mind." "I don't want to hear about it again," Paul said. "Well, if you let her do this, then what's next?" Paul seemed tired and on the edge of angry. "Never mind," Kate said. It wasn't in her purview anyway. Sometimes she was acutely aware of the absolute privacy conferred by Paul's marriage, or the ghost of his marriage. They could stay together forever, Paul and Kate, and there would still be some core that would remain untouchable to her. She was going to change the subject, but then a noise drew their attention outside. A car was pulling into the driveway. Now the car was parking right next to their car. It was Juna. Kate recognized her right away. Oh, God! Was she going to come inside? The stain on the rug was gone, but neither of them was wearing pants. Kate and Paul had both hunched down out of the woman's sight line. "Close the curtains," Paul hissed. "Well, she'll know we just closed them because she's here," she said. They were both whispering urgently. "So," he said, "she should have warned us she was showing up." Kate watched the woman get out of the car, but she didn't come to the door. She was going to the small outdoor shed. She unlocked the padlock. She didn't glance up at the house. "What's she doing?" Paul said. "Hold on." Before Kate pulled the curtains closed, she looked out again. The doors of the outdoor shed were wide open now, Juna busy moving boxes out onto the grass. Doing what exactly? Not their business. They kept crouching on the carpet. "How long is she going to be out there?" "Not like we're going anywhere," Kate said. Their dinner reservation was still a half hour away. The feeling of being trapped settled in. Although it hadn't occurred to them to, say, sit out on the porch and admire the changing light, now that they couldn't do such a thing, it seemed very unfair, Juna's presence. Much better to feel thwarted. It took them longer than it should have to get dressed. They'd be a little late for their reservation. The restaurant was only a 10-minute walk away, no shoulder on the road, most of the way there, but there wasn't that much traffic. Kate put on her jacket. She ran her fingers through her damp hair. Paul was lagging as usual. Kate waited for him on the porch. It was lavender outside, the nice evening light, the insects hazing in the grass and brambles. Kate bent to put on her shoes and had nearly straightened up before she realized that Juno was standing at the base of the porch steps. "Oh!" Kate had forgotten about Juno. She smiled to cover how startled she was. "I didn't see you, sorry." No response. Kate waited for the woman to introduce herself. The woman didn't. Paul would be out any moment, and that would be good, Kate thought. He'd break this strange tension. "Sorry," the woman said finally. "That's mine. Is that my coat?" Kate looked down at herself. My coat? Is that mine? Kate smiled at her dumbly. No, it's my coat. Did you go in the downstairs closet? Were there cameras or something? Her face got hot. No, 'cause I have that coat in the closet, that exact coat. Kate looked down at herself again. Yeah, sorry, this is my coat. It's like a pretty popular style of coat, she added, in what sounded like a desperate fake voice. It was Kate's coat. She'd had it since college, so why did she suddenly have the fear that she had stolen it from this woman? Do you want to go, like, check that your coat is still in the closet? Sorry, Judah said, sorry. Her eyes were squinted still, unpleasantly. Such a pretty woman looking very unpretty. Paul finally emerged onto the porch. Oh, hi, he said, smiling at Juno. It's such a great house. Thanks again. Juno made a face that Kate was familiar with, downloading the information of Kate and Paul's age difference. Though the disapproval usually wasn't this visible, this obvious. Paul darted a glance at Kate. Well, we're heading to dinner. Have a good night, Paul said. What was that? He murmured to Kate as they walked past Juno's car. Wait a sec. Kate didn't want to say anything until they were entirely out of Juno's sight line. They turned right out of the driveway and headed toward town. Kate looked back. Juno was hidden behind the trees. She waited an extra beat anyway before she said anything. The restaurant was staffed by good-looking students from the nearby college, their skin ruddy with the health they were intent on destroying, cigarette packs sticking out of their back pockets. Their waiter recited the specials off his notepad. They both got cocktails. Kate pointed at the menu, rather than say the humiliating name of the cocktail out loud. As she drank, she watched the people walking past the tall windows, expecting that Juno would be among them. She wasn't. At the bar was a young guy, maybe a few years younger than Kate. He was some kind of volunteer paramedic sitting in his uniform on the very edge of his stool, visibly pleased with himself. He was loud, addressing the bartender and the whole room at the same time. This car just flipped, the guy said, totally on its roof, like full on. The bartender watched him talk with a perfunctory expression of interest, all her actual energy expended in the busy motions of her hands. Could have been a lot worse, the guy said. He had an expectant shine in his cheeks, anticipating some kind of response. Admiration, Kate guessed. She accidentally caught his eye and looked away quickly. Young men are horrible, she said. She was drunk after a bottle of wine at dinner, plus the embarrassing cocktails. Maybe this was actually a fun trip. They were going to put a movie on back at the house. Who's watching this crap? Paul said, reclining on the bed, scrolling through the recently watched on his laptop. Kate said it was just his son, probably. She did not mention that she'd given Paul's Netflix password to her ex, Paul's algorithm now thoroughly torqued. They couldn't agree on a movie, and it was still so early they could walk to the pub. Sunday was open mic night. They'd learned from a lively bulletin in town. And they had to go to the bakery for breakfast tomorrow, their friend had insisted. Blue corn pancakes. Those sounded foul, but everyone, they had been assured, loved them. Sure, they would do all these things, all these activities. Kate just wanted to close her eyes for a second. A quick nap before they went out again. 20 minutes, that was all she needed. A brief time out to metabolize some of this alcohol. When she opened her eyes, it was 1 a.m. Paul was awake, still fully dressed, reading in bed beside her. The lamp was on. F-word, Kate said. I know, Paul said. I just woke up, too. I was trying to let you sleep. I'm starving, she said. Do you think anything is still open? Definitely not. Kate groaned. Now I'm too hungry to fall asleep. Let's just try, okay? Paul put away his book. Kate unbuttoned her jeans and kicked them down her legs. They stared up at the ceiling. After a while, Paul turned out the light. "Let's just wake up really early tomorrow," Paul said in the darkness. His voice sounded strained. "Okay? Then we can nap in the afternoon, but we'll still be on schedule." "Try to sleep." Kate thought this over and over. "Just close your eyes. Just fall asleep." Already past 11 by the time they woke up, there would be no blue corn pancakes, no sourdough toast or cardamom buns or cappuccinos. There would be no food at all. Everything was closed on Mondays, it turned out. They had watery coffee from the rental's blighted mocha pot. Kate had some of Paul's chocolate. It left a strange film on her tongue. Maybe cigarettes weren't even that bad, Kate thought, forcing herself to swallow the tasteless chocolate. They'd recently watched a documentary about a singer who'd smoked his whole life and died at 80. Didn't seem terrible. Unless you were 80, probably, and then it would seem terrible. They drove around looking for something that was open. There was a farm stand in a low, new-looking building with a burgundy corrugated metal roof. So much of the new construction around here seemed to be painted that same burgundy or forest green. Some of the fruit had stickers on it. It looked pallid. Kate suspected, but did not say that none of it was grown there. There were baked goods wrapped tightly in saran wrap, and jars of honey with the farm logo, and bags of multicolored dried pasta, also stickered with the farm logo. They got a slab of brownie and an oatmeal cookie. Paul insisted on buying a bag of apples. "It's not even the season," Kate said peevishly. Paul took a few bites of an apple in the car. There was no crunch. "It's good," he said brightly. They decided to go to the Wilderness Preserve, another recommendation from their friend. They drove for a long time looking for the preserve. Kate worried privately that Paul was lost. She had started to worry more about this lately, that Paul was lost, that he was, in some fundamental way, disoriented. The Wilderness Preserve, they discovered, was also closed on Mondays. They had a just okay dinner at the Mexican restaurant the next town over. The chips were warm and bad, their warmth basically canceling out their badness. And it was fun whenever they made the wordless agreement as a couple that they would drink, really drink. The mutual suspension of judgment was heady, like a jaunt through international waters, some temporarily ungovernable zone. If they'd had cigarettes, Kate was sure Paul would have smoked them. On the way out, Kate took a pocketful of cheap peppermint candies from the bowl by the register and crunched through them on the drive home, the windows open to the swimmy dark. Had Juna been there while they were out? No, that was crazy, but something seemed different in the house. Shifted around. "Like, wasn't your book on the couch?" Kate said. "You're just being drunk," Paul said with fondness. Kate was drunk, it was true, and because she was drunk, it didn't seem so bad that Juna had been in the house, because she definitely had been. They split another Norco. "We have to leave by 10 a.m., okay?" Juna had been very clear. If you stayed past 10 in the morning, she charged you for another night. 10:01 or 10:02? "You think she's just lying in wait to catch you?" Kate said. "Or is it like those mini bars in hotels that have sensors, so if you even lift up a Coke, they bill you?" The windows were dark, reflecting the lights of the living room. Juna wasn't out there, obviously. Still, Kate got up to close the curtains. She sat in the hammock and let herself dangle for a while. It smelled like other people's bodies. "Does anyone ever wash this?" she said tonelessly. "Probably not." Kate heaved herself out. They still had a few beers left in the fridge. "Want one?" Paul did. While Kate opened the beers, Paul got himself into the hammock, ass first. One foot still touched the ground. He kicked to rock the hammock back and forth. "Nice," he said. Paul looked at the ceiling as the hammock rocked. Was he having a good time? Kate wondered. When they were in the car, Paul's son had FaceTimed to ask for the frickin' Wi-Fi password because the frickin' internet wasn't working again. It was so frickin' annoying. Paul had soothed his son with shocking patience. "It's a zero, not an O. And uppercase P," he'd said onto the phone. "Uppercase." Back in the city, the ex-wife would be moistening the dog's food with a little goat's milk, readying the steroid shot. It hadn't even been a question whether Paul would help take care of the dog, despite the monkish haircut. The hammock was rocking faster now, Paul peeping out as he swung. "Are you ever like, what happened to me?" Kate said. "Why am I in this stupid upstate house with a stupid Tulum hammock?" "No." Maybe Paul really didn't regret any of it. He kept rocking. He stretched back, surrendering himself fully to the fabric. "It's not even that nice," Kate was about to say, of lying in a hammock. Before she could say it, one end of the hammock snapped. Paul fell to the ground. "Oh, God!" The first instinct was to laugh, but it wasn't funny. Paul groaned. His eyes closed, then sputtered back open. Kate was kneeling beside him. "Damn," she said. "Damn, baby." He looked drained of life. "Oh, F-word. Oh, F-word." The impulse to touch him, her hands hovering. She needed to call someone. She understood that. She had to find the address of the house in the email from Juna to say where they were. Kate had no memory of letting them into the house, the paramedics, but now they were here, efficient and relentless and managing the situation. They'd suggested that she give them some space. Maybe the suggestion had been more of a demand. She stood dumbly by the fireplace. She didn't want to ask yet if Paul was okay. And they would have said something, wouldn't they, if he really wasn't? They were moving him carefully onto a hard plastic stretcher. Like in that sleepover game, light as a feather, stiff as a board, multiple paramedics crowded around to lift Paul's prone body. It took an excruciatingly long time. He was blinking. He said something quietly. A good sign, surely. Kate should find Paul's phone. She didn't have his kids' phone numbers. It was only in that lull, reminding herself to look around for Paul's phone, that she saw a young man hanging back, crouched by the fireplace. His outfit was a little different from the others, and it took a second before she placed him, the young man from the restaurant bar, in his volunteer paramedic uniform. A walkie-talkie was squalling on his belt holster. He watched the proceedings intently, ready to leap into action. "Easy does it," the young man said as the others strapped Paul to the board. None of them responded or even acknowledged him. Why was he here, the young man, lurking, useless? Kate tried to ignore him, tried to concentrate whatever scant faculty she currently possessed on the unfolding situation. Her eye was drawn to the carpet. She stared at it. The stain, she realized, was still there, faint but still visible. The young man drove the car along the highway, Kate in the passenger seat. The car was just the man's hatchback, nothing special, following behind the ambulance that carried Paul. For some reason, they had not allowed her to ride in the ambulance with Paul. "But the movies," Kate had wanted to say, "they let everyone do it in the movies." Maybe she hadn't insisted with enough vigor. Maybe there was a correct way to act in these situations, and she was already performing her role in this crisis badly. The ambulance had its lights going up ahead, but not the siren, because there weren't any other cars on the road, probably. But it did make her anxious, this lack of urgency. At what point did she need to let Paul's kids know? God, or the ex-wife? Kate checked her pocket again to make sure she had Paul's phone. "He'll be fine," the young man said in a chatty tone. "I've seen people walk away from, like, really worse stuff, like car crashes, full-on rollovers." They shouldn't have opened the closet door, Kate thought, as if that had caused everything. A dumb thought, but maybe this was how it felt when life cleaved into the before and after. It was this dumb. The young man kept talking. Something about the car accidents they had up here, a new measure from the county to put in a roundabout. She wasn't listening. The ambulance was no longer in front of them. How had he managed to lose it on this empty road? Drive, she wanted to mutter at him, like in the movies, but she stayed quiet. Paul would be fine. They'd be together soon. She tried to seem occupied with staring out the passenger side window. You're looking out like there's something to see, the young man said cheerily. It was black out there, it was true. Nothing to see but varying shades of darkness. Maybe he'd meant it as a joke, and probably he'd be smiling if she glanced over to check. But something stopped her. She didn't want to look over at the young man. It seemed important that she not look at him. Why had she just got in the car with this stranger? Had the paramedics even told her to do it? She couldn't remember. Maybe he wasn't taking her to the hospital at all. Her own phone rang in her lap, cutting through the quiet. The screen showed an unfamiliar number. She answered the call. Hello? Kate said into the silence. She should have insisted on staying with Paul, she realized. That had been another mistake. Hello? Kate said again. Excuse me, the voice said. Excuse me, the voice repeated. Is this Kate? It was Juna, and she had stopped by the house. Why had she stopped by the house? And found all the doors open and the lights on, and she was mad, was the gist. And Juna would be contacting the website in the morning, if not the police. She sounded nearly hysterical. It's about respect, Juna was saying. You people, she said. Everything okay? The young man asked Kate in a stage whisper, his face ghoulish in the wan light. Kate saw then that they were parked in front of a hospital, under the concrete arch of the emergency entrance. Kate put her hand on the car door. She nodded at the man. The phone still pressed to her ear, Juna's unending stream of invectives slithering into her brain. She'd explained the situation to Juna, was about to explain, but when she did, it would already be too late. Kate had taken receipt of the message, understood the call for the curse it was. Almost a month later, Paul was installed back in their apartment, subject to the daily ministrations of a therapy team, who moved each of his limbs in steady, maddeningly slow arcs. There had been so many loads of laundry those first days they were back. Endless legal pads that Kate had filled with notes and names and instructions and underlying dosage reminders and the anxious, pointless rows of checkered boxes that she had doodled in moments of stress since she was a child. She kept her phone on her at all times. There were innumerable calls, crucial points to follow up on, each thread equally important. Her phone had never seen so much use. The constant notifications, that buoyant little ping that signaled a new email, a resonant chime like optimism itself. And it was a time when the situation was still fluid, subject to change, and so Kate should have jumped at the sound. Someone might still deliver good news. It could be the second opinion doctor. It could be the out-of-network neurosurgeon. It could be a friend of a friend sending along details of some experimental intervention that would tilt them toward a happier ending. Yet, she had noticed a slight hesitance to check her phone, to face what might have arrived. Kate was afraid. It was illogical, a stupid fear circling mutely below the relentless din of the ongoing crisis, but it was there, and she was afraid of Juna. Kate knew she was being crazy. Knowing this didn't help. Kate had explained everything to Juna on that phone call, or everything she knew at that time, the night at the hospital that already seemed many eons ago. There was no world in which Juna would pose any kind of problem. If anything, Juna was the one who should be afraid, the one losing sleep just waiting for some lawyer's missive. Juna should be terrified. Maybe she had stolen Juna's jacket, Kate thought, idly, dumping the dregs of Paul's meal replacement shake down the drain. She caught herself. She hadn't. She told herself again, more firmly, she definitely hadn't. She would never admit it to anyone, this embarrassing Juna fixation. There was no real way to say it. What was she afraid of? Exactly. What could Juna even do? Leave them a bad review? Yes, maybe, and maybe it would say everything. That was the part that Kate couldn't really explain. Somehow Juna would know the things they had done wrong, all the mistakes, recent and ancient, they had ever made. She would know the ugly little ways they used each other, the petty private cudgels they'd made of their own emotions. Had they ever loved each other, she and Paul? Kate thought dully. Once Paul had said as a joke, "I love you as much as I'm capable of loving anyone." And Kate had laughed and said something like, "Me too." But there was some part of her that knew it was true. Juna would know it too. Juna would see right to their core, inventory their paltry souls, and make these findings known. They weren't good people. And Juna knew it. They'd got what they deserved. Kate kept the windows shut in the apartment and the air conditioning on. The air was stale. Paul's eyes roved around the room and then landed on Kate's. His pupils dilated, his eyes wetted. Kate squeezed his hand. "There, there," she said, or thought she said. And now, from the fiction section of the January 13, 1939 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Fables for Our Time by James Thurber. Once upon a Sunday, there was a city mouse who went to visit a country mouse. He hid away on a train the country mouse had told him to take, only to find that on Sundays it did not stop at Beddington. Hence, the city mouse could not get off at Beddington and catch a bus for Seibert's Junction, where he was to be met by the country mouse. The city mouse was, in fact, carried on to Middleburg, where he waited 3 hours for a train to take him back. When he got back to Beddington, he found that the last bus for Seibert's Junction had just left, so he ran and he ran and he ran, and he finally caught the bus and crept aboard, only to find that it was not the bus for Seibert's Junction at all, but was going in the opposite direction through Pell's Hollow and Grum to a place called Wimberby. When the bus finally stopped, the city mouse got out into a heavy rain and found that there were no more buses that night going anywhere. "To hell with it," the city mouse said, and he walked back to the city. Moral of the story, stay where you are. You're sitting pretty. One afternoon, a big wolf waited in a dark forest for a little girl to come along carrying a basket of food to her grandmother. Finally, a little girl did come along, and she was carrying a basket of food.
"Are you carrying that basket to your grandmother?" asked the wolf.
The little girl said yes, she was. So the wolf asked her where her grandmother lived, and the little girl told him, and he disappeared into the wood. When the little girl opened the door of her grandmother's house, she saw that there was somebody in bed with a nightcap and nightgown on. She had approached no nearer than 25 feet from the bed when she saw that it was not her grandmother, but the wolf. For even in a nightcap, a wolf does not look any more like your grandmother than the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer looks like Calvin Coolidge. So the little girl took an automatic out of her basket and shot the wolf dead. Moral: it is not so easy to fool little girls nowadays as it used to be. Once upon a time, there were two turkeys, an old turkey and a young turkey. The old turkey had been cock of the walk for many years, and the young turkey wanted to take his place. "I'll knock that old buzzard cold one of these days," the young turkey told his friends.
"Sure you will, Joe, sure you will," his friends said, for Joe was treating them to some corn he had found. Then the friends went and told the old turkey what the young turkey had said.
"I'll have his gizzard," said the old turkey, setting out some corn for his visitor.
"Sure you will, Doc, sure you will," said the visitors.
One day, the young turkey walked over to where the old turkey was telling tales of his prowess in battle.
"I'll bat your teeth into your crop," said the young turkey.
"You and who else?" said the old turkey.
So they began to circle around each other, sparring for an opening. Just then, the farmer who owned the turkey swept up the young one and carried him off and wrung his neck. Moral: youth will be served, frequently stuffed with chestnuts. Once upon a time, there was a tiger who escaped from a zoo in the United States and made his way back to the jungle. During his captivity, the tiger had learned a great deal about how men do things, and he thought he would apply their methods to a life in the jungle. During his captivity, the tiger had learned a great deal about how men do things, and he thought he would apply their methods to life in the jungle. The first day he was home, he met a leopard, and he said, "There's no use in you and me hunting for food. We'll make the other animals bring it to us." "How will we do that?" asked the leopard. "Easy," said the tiger. "You and I will tell everybody that we are going to put on a fight and that every animal will have to bring a freshly killed boar in order to get in and see the fight. Then we will just spar around and not hurt each other. Later you can say you broke a bone in your paw during the second round, and I will say I broke a bone in my paw during the first round. Then we will announce a return engagement, and they'll have to bring us more wild boars." "I don't think this will work," said the leopard. "Oh, yes, it will," said the tiger. "You just go around saying that you can't help winning because I'm a big palooka, and I will go around saying I can't lose because you are a big palooka, and everybody will want to come and see the fight." So the leopard went around telling everybody that he couldn't help winning because the tiger was a big palooka, and the tiger went around telling everybody he couldn't lose because the leopard was a big palooka. The night of the fight came, and the tiger and the leopard were very hungry because they hadn't gone out and done any hunting at all. They wanted to get the fight over as soon as possible and eat some of the freshly killed wild boars, which all the animals would bring to the fight. But when the hour of the combat came, none of the animals at all showed up. "The way I look at it," Fox had told them, "is this. If the leopard can't help winning and the tiger can't lose, it will be a draw, and a draw is a very dull thing to watch, particularly when fought by fighters who are both big palookas." The animals all saw the logic of this and stayed away from the arena. When it got to be midnight, and it was obvious that none of the animals would appear, and that there wouldn't be any wild boar meat to devour, the tiger and the leopard fell upon each other in a rage. They were both injured so badly, and they were both so worn out by hunger, that a couple of wild boars who came wandering along attacked them and killed them easily. Moral of the story: imitating the ways of the human being will get you nowhere fast. A large spider in an old house built a beautiful web in which to catch flies. Every time a fly landed on the web and was entangled in it, the spider devoured him. So that when another fly came along, he would think the web was a safe and quiet place in which to rest. One day, a fairly intelligent fly buzzed around above the web so long without lighting that the spider appeared and said, "Come on down." But the fly was too clever for him and said, "I never light when I don't see other flies, and I don't see any other flies in your house." So he flew away until he came to a place where there were a great many other flies. He was about to settle down among them when a bee buzzed up and said, "Hold it, stupid! That's fly paper! All those flies are trapped!" "Don't be silly," said the fly. "They're dancing!" So he settled down and became stuck to the fly paper with all the other flies. Moral of the story: there is no safety in numbers or in anything else. There was once a lion who coveted an eagle's wings. So he sent a message to the eagle asking him to call. And when the eagle came to the lion's den, the lion said, "I will trade you my mane for your wings." "Keep talking, brother," said the eagle. "Without my wings, I could no longer fly." "So what?" said the lion. "I can't fly now, but that doesn't keep me from being king of beasts. I became king of beasts on account of my magnificent mane." "All right," said the eagle.
But give me your mane first. Just approach a little nearer, said the lion, so that I can hand it to you. The eagle came closer, and the lion clapped a huge paw on him, pinning him to the ground.
Come across with these wings, he snarled.
So the lion took the eagle's wings, but kept his own mane. The eagle was very despondent for a while, and then he had an idea.
I bet you can't fly off the top of that great rock yonder, said the eagle.
Who, me? Said the lion. And he walked to the top of the rock and took off. His weight was too great for the eagle's wings to support, and besides, he did not know how to fly, never having tried it before. So he crashed at the foot of the rock and burst into flames. The eagle hastily climbed down to him, regained his wings, and took off the lion's mane, which he put about his own neck and shoulders. Flying back to the rocky nest where he lived with his mate, he decided to have some fun with her. So, covered with the lion's mane, he poked his head into the nest and in a deep, awful voice said, "Hoo!" His mate, who was very nervous anyway, grabbed a pistol from a bureau drawer and shot him dead, thinking he was a lion. Moral of the story, never allow a nervous female to have access to a pistol, no matter what you're wearing. Not so very long ago, there was a very fine gander. He was strong and smooth and beautiful, and he spent most of his time singing to his wife and children. One day, somebody who saw him strutting up and down in his yard and singing remarked, "There is a very proper gander." An old hen overheard this and told her husband about it that night in the roost. "They said something about propaganda," she said. "I've always suspected that," said the rooster, and he went around the barnyard next day telling everybody that the very fine gander was a dangerous bird, more than likely a hawk in gander's clothing. A small brown hen remembered a time when, at a great distance, she had seen the gander talking with some hawks in the forest. "They were up to no good," she said. A duck remembered that the gander had once told him he did not believe in anything.
"He said, 'Down with the flag, too,'" said the duck.
A guinea hen recalled that she had once seen somebody who looked very much like the gander throw something that looked a great deal like a bomb. Finally, everybody snatched up sticks and stones and descended on the gander's house. He was strutting in his front yard, singing to his children and his wife. "There he is," everybody cried. "Hawk lover, unbeliever, flag hater, bomb thrower." So they set upon him and drove him out of the country. Moral of the story, anybody who you or your wife think is going to overthrow the government by violence must be driven out of the country. Once upon a time, a little red hen was picking up stones and worms and seeds in a barnyard when something fell on her head. "The heavens are falling down," she shouted, and she began to run, still shouting, "The heavens are falling down! The heavens are falling down!" All the hens that she met and all the roosters and turkeys and ducks laughed at her, smugly, the way you laugh at one who is terrified when you aren't.
"What did you say?" they chortled. "The heavens are falling down," cried the little red hen.
Finally, a very pompous rooster said to her, "Don't be silly, my dear. It was only a pea that fell on your head." And he laughed and laughed, and everybody else except the little red hen laughed. Then suddenly, with an awful roar, great chunks of crystallized cloud and huge blocks of icy blue sky began to drop on everybody from above, and everybody was killed. The laughing rooster and the little red hen and everybody else in the barnyard, for the heavens actually were falling down. Moral of the story, it wouldn't surprise me a bit if they did. A young and impressionable moth once set his heart on a certain star. He told his mother about this, and she counseled him to set his heart on a bridge lamp instead. "Stars aren't the thing to hang around," she said. "Lamps are the thing to hang around."
"You get somewhere that way," said the moth's father. "You don't get anywhere chasing stars."
But the moth would not heed the words of either parent. Every evening at dusk, when the star came out, he would start flying toward it, and every morning at dawn he would crawl back home, worn out with his vain endeavor. One day his father said to him, "You haven't burned a wing in months, boy, and it looks to me as if you were never going to. All your brothers have been badly burned flying around street lamps, and all your sisters have been terribly singed flying around house lamps. Come on now, get out of here and get yourself scorched. A big strapping moth like you without a mark on him." The moth left his father's house, but he would not fly around street lamps, and he would not fly around house lamps. He went right on trying to reach the star, which was 4 1/3 light years, or 25 trillion miles away. The moth thought it was just caught in the top branches of an elm. He never did reach that star, but he went right on trying, night after night, and when he was very, very old, he began to think that he really had reached the star, and he ran around saying so. This gave him a deep and lasting pleasure, and he lived to a great old age. His parents and his brothers and his sisters had all been burned to death when they were quite young. Moral of the story: who flies afar from the sphere of our sorrow is here today and here tomorrow. And finally, a poem by Taras Shevchenko in the October 30th, 2023 issue of The New Yorker. "And the sky remains unwashed, and the waves sleep. Reeds bend in no wind like drunks. My God, how long will I keep boring the waves from inside this open prison? God's mum as the fields of yellowing grass. He'll never tell the truth, but there's no one else to ask." We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.